This is KUSP in Santa Cruz. My name is Jane Wade, and the show is called the Monterey Bay Review, public affairs programming for the Central California coast. Today, I'm in the studio with Michael Beatty, who brought us a taped interview with Mae Brussel. And Michael, I'd like you to start out by telling us what we're going to be listening to.
Well, Mae Brussel is an investigative reporter. She's been investigating for about 20 years, and I've heard her for about 18 months. Actually, a strange thing happened because about 18 months ago, a friend of mine, Tim, who was born in Illinois and grew up in America and is about as American as apple pie, came up to me and said, "What do you know about the Knights of Malta?" And I looked at him and I said, "Well, what do you know about the Knights of Malta?" And I should explain that I've lived in Italy for many years, and the Knights of Malta have a sort of embassy in Rome, close to the Spanish Steps. And they're a sort of organization like the Lions or something. That's the way I've always thought of them. And Tim took me to his home and gave me a cassette, and I listened to Mae Brussel on the subject of the Knights of Malta, and I've been hooked ever since. It was outrageous, and I thought it was all rubbish when I first listened, and I just kept on listening more or less regularly. And after about a year and a half of this, I went to Vicky, the news editor, and I asked her if I could do an interview with Mae Brussel, and she said, "Sure, try it." And then you, Jane, came along and offered a full hour. So what I've done, I went down to her house and I talked to her for about 2 hours. I don't know, if you've listened to her program, you'll know that she does not follow one thread all the way. And I didn't want to bring her into the studio and have her talk here as though it was part of her World Watchers program. I wanted to talk to her, I wanted to get a few subjects, and I wanted to try and keep them as compact as possible so that anyone who hasn't heard Mae Brussel by listening to this program will get a pretty good idea of her views and opinions. And people that have heard her will get an option, get a chance to hear it in a more concise form. I've chosen about three main topics, I think. I'm going to start with the Kennedy assassinations, which was where she actually came to prominence. And I'm going to move on to the narcotics trade, like you said in the introduction. And she relates that to the Reagan administration, which was a big surprise to me. And she's got a pretty dim outlook of the future here in the United States, which I thought would also be interesting to look at.
Okay, so what are we going to start with?
I'm going to start with the Kennedy assassinations. What I did in this talk, I decided to choose some topics that I thought would relate better to people living in the United States. People may know quite a bit about the Kennedy assassinations, but this is going to be a different point of view. I wasn't really interested in getting into the exotics of the Knights of Malta and the Italian Freemasons and the Masonic Lodges. So I've tried to keep it domestic. And you're going to hear right here from the Kennedy assassinations, she brings the Nazis into it. I was pretty surprised to hear this. And this is a thread that runs right through the interview. The Nazis seem to crop up in everything. Mae Brussel seems to feel that the Nazis have riddled the United States, at least at an intellectual level.
I would have to say, as also a Mae Brussel listener for many years, that idea, I think, was considered a lot more outrageous a few years ago, but now with Klaus Barbie and links to the cocaine trade and all sorts of stuff that's coming out in the mainstream press.
Well, I mean, I'm really chuffed that, I'm really pleased that President Reagan is going to Bitburg, because this is giving us a real topical, we're getting a really close look at what President Reagan actually is doing and why we're getting a different view here of why he's doing it. Nobody seems to have approached this bizarre act by President Reagan in the way that Mae Brussel does. And as we get through this interview, you're going to hear her opinions about this. I should mention at this point that I talked to her about 2 weeks ago. In fact, 2 weeks ago this Friday, so it's the 19th of April, I think. And so the subject was a lot less close. I mean, President Reagan is now in Germany as we speak, and today's May the 2nd, and he's going to lay the wreath on May the 8th.
All right, let's get started, and let's let Mae Brussel speak for herself.
I settled here in Carmel 20 years ago, so I'm just an ordinary citizen living in Carmel, California.
No, I am what I would like to think an ordinary American would be, specifically a concerned person. If a president of the United States has his head blown off and there's so much controversy and discrepancy, I would like to think that every American would be concerned about that.
So what set this ordinary American on the course of investigation? How did you get involved?
Well, I just didn't believe that John Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald. And I was one of 11 people in the country that started our research the day that John Kennedy was killed, and then really escalated it 2 days later when Lee Harvey Oswald was killed by Jack Ruby. That combination of the Marxist from the Soviet Union, the president who wants the Todd, and it's the end of the era of Eisenhower and Nixon as vice president, that Cold War era, and then this crazy nightclub owner who steps into a Dallas police department and wipes out the Marxist and who killed the liberal president. That trio just was too much for me, and we were living in Los Angeles at the time and we had five children, and I decided that this was their world. I really did. As a parent, I thought that it is the obligation of the, I guess, the mother hen or whatever, to protect those people that she puts out in the world and see, this is planet Earth, I'm on it, what is happening to my Earth? Just as now we see the pollution in the air and the acid rain and the takeover of the media and horrendous things, these horrible bombs and Star Wars and everything about us, I could foresee all of these things that if you put your hands, give your hand over to people who have killed the elected leader of the country, then you end the electoral process, which is what happened. And then your children will live in bondage or slavery, which is what is happening with the national debt.
So killing Kennedy has ended pre-choice?
Well, that was a coup in the United States. There's never been an election since then, because after Kennedy was killed, there were interims with the intention of the heir selected to take over. And Lyndon Johnson, of course, moved right in and was very much part of that conspiracy. And then when there was to be an election, Lyndon Johnson was to run, he stepped down and I was making bets. I made a lot of money that he wouldn't run. And he let heir apparent Robert Kennedy have it. And Robert Kennedy had his head again blown from the back of the head, not from the front, killed. And then Nixon was in. The man who ran against Kennedy in 1960 was in because two Kennedys were dead now, and Richard Nixon became the president.
Is that the motive for the murder?
The motive, there are a lot of motives for killing John Kennedy. I'm talking about the electoral process. Not jumping from that, then because of the Watergate scandal being so horrendous, with crook Nixon in and being reelected the second time and really planning a police state, the COINTELPRO program and MK Ultra, and with Agnew as vice president, tied into the Nazis, the Greek junta, and world and international Nazis. He was much farther right, and he's much more dangerous even than Nixon, but there was Nixon with Watergate scandal. So that he appointed Gerald Ford of the Warren Commission to be his interim president on the condition that he's pardoned for any past crimes, which would be horrendous. So Ford was handpicked to take over, and then Carter took over from the Republicans for one interim.
Let's go back. Let's go back to the last democratically elected president then, who was
John Kennedy.
John Kennedy.
Yes.
Now, you studied the question.
Yes, of course.
And this is where really you came to prominence as an investigative journalist.
Yeah.
What were your conclusions? There were many theories thrown out about the murder.
Oh, you didn't read the article I did. I did it for Rebel last year on the 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Well, I'll have to give you one. It's called it's on the Nazi takeover of America, and it's the connections of the German Nazis into our government that had a role in the murdering of our president, because Richard Nixon was long supporter of the Nazis. As a matter of fact, I was the first person in the United States who published in 1972 on the story of Watergate. Within 3 weeks of the arrest at the Watergate Hotel, I wrote an article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And that article goes into the Nazi connections of Nixon, the assassination of Kennedy, the links of Watergate back to the assassination. That was the first published article in the world of Richard Nixon's links to the German Nazis. I believe that getting rid of Kennedy was part of a larger plan. There were like 12 or 14 good reasons. If you have time, I can tell you why they wanted him dead. But the orders came that he isn't one of us and we've got to get rid of him. For one thing, he didn't invade Cuba. He refused to kill Castro and take over the island. And one of the bases for Nazi wealth is narcotics, organized crime. So anyway, the reasons to kill Kennedy, he wanted to take the oil depletion allowance away from them. And there were people in Texas like the Murchinses and H.L. Hunt and Bum Bright, and he's very wealthy in the news these days all the time, Wall Street Journal. The reason to take away their tax benefits, made them furious. And besides that, his brother was the only attorney general, the only person in the country going after organized crime. Now, organized crime, according to David Yollop, who wrote a book on the murder of John Paul I in God's name, was talking about the money washing of the crime syndicate in this country. It's about $40 billion a year that goes through the American banks of narcotic money. And after Robert Kennedy was killed, then Carlos Monticello and Sandro Trafficante and John Rosselli and Maya Lansky and the Bonanna family and the Genoveses and the Gambinos were home free, and they divided up this country and the world with the narcotic traffic. And Kennedy pulled back from Cuba and wouldn't invade Cuba, which was the headquarters of prostitution and crime outside the boundaries of the United States. And he was talking about pulling out of Southeast Asia in 1964 when he was reelected. In the United States, where we had segregation, John Kennedy and his attorney general brother began entering a black person in the university in Mississippi. And they had to bring in the troops to do it. And when you begin educating the blacks equal to the whites with doctor's degrees and MDs, then they have the money to move into your neighborhood or marry your daughter. And the point is, if you keep them economically deprived, they can't have the mobility where you don't want to meet them or see them. You have to keep them at a slave labor, you know, or else you have to be doing the work someday, picking cotton with them if they can move up and be equal to you economically. So when he had to put General Walker, this far right winger of the Birch Society and the Christian Defense League, he had to put him into prison and mental hospital just to get a black person registered in Mississippi. So the civil rights thing, that goes against, like, the Nazis in this country that want to kill all blacks and all Jews. But, you know, it's harder to kill them if they're anchor persons on the television, the major network, you know. So the point is, like, when that's what happens when you get education, you get a white man's job. And they, so the Kennedys, besides the oil depletion thing, they had the nuclear test ban treaty, which was enough to kill him. It was horrendous to stop NASA, which was all Nazi. Von Braun and Dornberg and Rudolph and, you know, 900 Nazi scientists that came here that he was bucking up against with wanting to stop atomic weapons and testing. So he was hitting the Nazi scientists. He was hitting the racial segregationists. He was hitting the oil people who would keep the third world under their control in slavery with oil prices, so that it wasn't what he was doing was all across the board an organized crime, which is the funds for the resurgence of Nazis. They all could work together because sympathetically they wanted to get rid of him, and J. Edgar Hoover was vice president of Interpol before the war with Mr. Heydrich and Kaltenbrunner, who was hung, one of them was hung at Nuremberg. And he was vice president. It was set up by Hitler, a police force, a national, international police force. And our...
Interpol?
Interpol. He was vice president of Interpol. That was set up by Adolf Hitler in Vienna.
I never knew that.
Yes, I have pictures of all of the founding. And then when the war started and he invaded Poland, then they had to move it to some neutral place, and then they put it in Paris. But the network and all the files of people going back to the ones that...
This is the Interpol that we have
yes,
now.
Yes, yes. That's why they never caught a Nazi all these years. They're not after Nazis or drug dealers. Interpol doesn't catch anybody. It's a network of people that should be wiped out and then people that should be protected.
This is KUSP in Santa Cruz. We've been listening to a segment from an interview with Mae Brussel. Michael Beattie, who conducted that interview, is here talking to us today. Tell us what we listened to, Michael.
Well, I guess you heard it just the way I did. The thing that I think is interesting about Mae Brussel is that she starts out in the Kennedy assassination, and here we are 10 minutes later and we're discussing Interpol. And when you listen to her programs on a Monday night, one of the most off-putting things is the fact that she can put in so much information into 1 hour's broadcast. She just spews out names and places and organizations that you've never heard of, and you don't really know what you're listening. You're just bowled over by all this information. And what I tried to do when I talked to her was I tried to keep her on course. I wanted to talk about the Kennedy assassination, and then she would shoot off pursuing Nixon and Watergate and so on. So I drag her back, and then I go back to Kennedy, and I try and keep following the flow. And you can see right from here, she's looking back 20 years, and we've been infiltrated by Nazis, according to Mae Brussel. Now, if you believe that or not, that's your business. But listen to what she says. She follows. There is a flow in there. If you can pick out what she's actually saying, and she looks at the facts. She's not chasing an ideology. And yet, I mean, anybody recoils from the idea that anybody in power in this country today could be a Nazi. I mean, the idea is abominable. It's bizarre. It's macabre. And I don't really know whether to believe it or not. I just listened to Maeve Russell. I think I should point out, too, at this point, that she does have a very good investigative sense. She does take material that is available to all of us. She showed me around her library, and I'll talk a bit more about how I met her later on. But she has a vast collection of books. She reads newspapers by the dozen. She has the time to do all these things. These aren't sources that are plucked out of the blue. They're things that are under your nose. She just joins them together. And for me, when I first started listening to her, it was a load of rubbish. The thing that hooked me on Maeve Russell was her knowledge, her facts. When I heard her talking about things that happened in Italy, in my own home country, that nobody in the United States has heard of, my ears went up. I just sort of, you know, I thought, I scented something. How does she know about Liscio Gelli or Propaganda 2 two or three years before they become general knowledge in certain spheres in the United States? How does she put these things together? I mean, people are talking about things that have happened in Italy now, but Maeve Russell was talking about them 18 months ago.
So what do you have up for us next?
Well, the thing that another thing that bugs me about Maeve Russell is her ideology, her lack of it. And if you're involved in any of the ideologies she talks about, if you're a Nazi, you're going to be offended by Maeve Russell. There's no problem there. But also, if you're a Jew, if you're a feminist, if you're anything, you're going to be bugged by Maeve Russell somewhere down the road, because she doesn't have an ideology. And in a sense, that's what appeals to me as well, because I myself don't have much of an ideology, especially concerning affairs in this country. I've only been living here for 3 years, so I haven't got involved in any of the great movements here. And it appeals to me, and it repels me, because sometimes she'll offend you in a personal belief, you know? And you want to say, that's rubbish, I don't want to hear that. But you have to go on and listen to her facts, because it's fascinating, and try not to judge it, you know? I'm going to go on here now. We're going to continue also with the Kennedy assassination, but we're going to go on to the question of drugs. I mean, it flows from one to the other. And the thing that I noticed when I talked to her was her lack of ideology. And you're going to hear that in the next segment.
Okay, let's go.
You ignored the ideologies in many of your
stories.
No, I don't.
Okay, let me say, basically, I ignore the ideology. Yes, I do, for this reason. If, say, Sirhan is in the Ambassador Hotel, and he's caught right there with a group of people and Rosie Grier, and he's got a revolver that only shoots 8 bullets. And if the police department in Los Angeles has a 10 bullets records in the Ambassador Hotel that went into people, went into the ceiling, went into the woodwork, and if somebody, whether it's...
Sirhan murdered Robert...
We're talking about the Robert Kennedy assassination. Now, if somebody admits he's a security guard to Robert Kennedy, that he was behind him and he shot the man, pulled a gun and shot it that evening... And if the autopsy report of Thomas Noguchi says that the bullet was 1 inch from the back of the head, a burn right on the scalp. Now, I don't care whether it... I do care in the conclusion, but if there's 10 bullet holes and the wounds are a trajectory from the back to the front and Sirhan's in front, if my conclusion can prove that it's KGB that shot the second gun, I will accept that conclusion. If the conclusion is a man named Thane Caesar who said, yes, he shot the gun, and he was a security guard, and he was hired from Lockheed, then I know it was CIA and not KGB. I try to go with the evidence. In other words, if a man knocks on the... Lee Harvey Oswald's in the Soviet Union. He comes home with a wife from Minsk. He says he's anti-American. He gave our secrets of the Marines to the Russians. And you can say he's Russian. Now, he comes in June 1962 to Fort Worth, Texas, and a man knocks on the door. He testifies the Warren Commission. His name's George de Morenschild. He worked for Nelson Rockefeller. He worked for the CIA, the Defense Department. And he's calling on Marina Oswald, and he's with a man named Lawrence Orloff, who works with Henry Ford and with our government, a czarist, a white Russian who was left out of Russia at the time of the revolution. Now, two far-right wingers knock on the door and meet Lee and Marina Oswald, as testified in Volume 9 of the Warren Commission hearings, and de Morenschild says that he was followed by the FBI to Corpus Christi and wanted as a Nazi spy during World War II, and his cousin is a Nazi, known Nazi. If the people who knock on the door, Lee and Marina, tell you that they are related to and were suspects as Nazis during the war, If they said I was KGB, then I would look for Russians. And the point is that by their own testimony and by the documents, one by one, I'm not looking for an answer. I'm listening to what they're saying. See, and what adds up is the right-wing story. When Oswald goes to Soviet Union, he comes home and he says the testimony is that he's met at the harbor by Spaz-Rakin, and it's the World Anti-Communist League. Well,
could you say that name again?
Spaz-Rakin, Spaz-Rakin. And Oswald was corresponding with the most violent anti-communists, you know, in the United States, and his being brought home on a ship, he's met at the harbor by the World Anti-Communist League. And then he's interviewed for 2 days, and they give him a plane ticket to go to Fort Worth, where he meets George de Morenchild. Now, if you take, you know, all the Warren Commission hearings, everything, it isn't ideological that I'm putting into this place. The evidence and their own testimony is putting it into where my conclusions are. My conclusions are based upon the evidence I'm reading, not what I want to hear.
So, for instance, how do you square what I see as a circle in the sense that, coming forward a little to the narcotics trade, how do the mafia is generally considered to be a right-wing organization?
Absolutely.
How do you square that with the fact that they use Cuba to supply narcotics?
Well, see, I don't believe, like, say, Jack Anderson had an article this week about Cuba and Colombia. If Cuba is into narcotics, Castro, if they're into it, and we know that, say, the right wing has said Jews have all the money in the world and they're taking over the Rothschilds, and you read now that $1 billion is washed out of the Boston Bank. It's not Jewish. $300 or $500 million is missing out of Wells Fargo. It's not a Jewish bank. The Bank of America is missing $30 or $40 million. And the point is that the biggest narcotics in the world, this is verified by any study on narcotics, is coming out of Pakistan, which is our closest ally, and out of cocaine, out of Bolivia until the last elections. And the former president of Bolivia, who was the cocaine king with Klaus Barbie, was at the Republican convention in Dallas, Texas, entertained by this administration, the largest cocaine dealer in the world. Now, the Nugenhan Bank, which is the biggest narcotic traffic, they collapsed in Australia with 55 million to 1 billion missing. And when Mr. Nugent was found murdered, he had William Colby's card. They worked with the CIA. There's admirals and generals. There have been articles written, and the Wall Street Journal carries the narcotics traffic from Southeast Asia to Australia into this country. Now, none of this has anything to do with Castro. You tell me how much narcotics, the biggest empire of money in this country next to Exxon, is narcotic traffic. None of that is from Castro. The biggest industry in California, I have the figures in the other room, we can look them up. Marijuana, it equals the entire budget of Cuba for a year.
So
you're falling for the bait that Colombia gives communist Castro narcotics. He basically...
I thought you said earlier that the crime bosses went to Cuba.
Before Castro. That's why they hated Castro so
Batista,
much.
Batista, you mean?
Batista was all mafia and crime, yes. I was in Panama twice, once when I was like 9 years old, and once, we went through the Panama Canal, we landed in San Diego the day that war broke out in Poland. That's 1939. That's how long ago I was in Cuba the last time. And I was very impressionable. I was young, you know, almost ready to go to college. And it was prostitution, girls' prostitution. You know, I was just, you know, in my teens and just ready to finish high school. Batista's Cuba. And it's nightclubs and all kinds of stories that are impressionable, even to me, not even brought up as political. But it was a miserable place for people, you know, this terrible poverty. Now, there's a few articles that people that dislike Fidel Castro and the way he took over the hotels, the Hilton Hotel and the chains and nationalized everything, are trying to make look like narcotics in America come from Castro. I just cut out of the Washington Post yesterday, the narcotic center of America's Miami. They don't deal with Fidel Castro. They don't buy from Castro. They get directly from Peru narcotics, Bolivia narcotics, Brazil has gone into narcotics.
Colombia.
Colombia narcotics. But what percentage do you think goes through Fidel Castro. If Fidel Castro could deal narcotics, he would be so rich and powerful, because that's where the money is.
Well, let's look at the other side of the coin. Pakistan, as you just mentioned, is coming into the narcotic scene with heroin.
Coming in, that was the thing that upset the World Bank, actually, was when we took when Russia took Afghanistan, it upset the bank because the Shah of Iran was out. That's one of the things they had against Jimmy Carter, was he let the Shah out. The Paul Levy family were the biggest dealers of narcotics. I think his sister was arrested with $2 million worth of heroin. Remember at Marseille on the way to Switzerland? The Shah made a deal with Turkey. They paid them. American taxpayers gave Turkey like $43 million not to grow narcotics. And so the Shah would have the monopoly of Southeast Asia when Nixon...
In Pakistan, now that the Shah is dead, of course, Iran's off the scene.
Yes.
Pakistan used to have legalized, franchised government shops selling opium and heroin to people. And it is said that in 1980, under Western government's pressure, Pakistan was being paid once again to cut its poppy crops, not to sell heroin legally.
That was only when Butoh was alive. When Henry Kissinger put in Zia, then it became the largest narcotic dealer in the world. And wherever Henry Kissinger goes with it, Southeast Asia or South America, the traffic is horrendous. If you take Turkey and you take Pakistan and you take Bolivia under the administrations and then entertain these people at the Republican convention, add up, and I save every article on major drug arrests or articles on drugs and narcotics. What is Cuba? See, in other words, you're so tiny. Uh-huh. It's not ideological. If you would sit with me and we'd go over the drug articles and pull those out, it would be ideological to say that Cuba distributes drugs.
Okay, so again, this is ignoring an ideology in the sense that President Reagan is the man that sets himself up as anti-drug, anti-hippie culture, the recreational use of things as like marijuana,
yeah,
and all the rest of it. I mean, it's destroying America's youth.
Well, he sets himself up as all those things. But who was his best friend and confidant who he put on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board? Alfred Bloomingdale, with Vicky Morgan's sexual habits living simultaneously with Bloomingdale and Robert Vesco. Bernie Kornfield. She shared a house in Hollywood, up in the Truesdale Estates, with Bernie Kornfield, the partner of Vesco, and Bloomingdale simultaneously living with both of them, while Bloomingdale is the advisor to our governor 8 years and then to be president. And he also, while he's the great apple pie man and great religious guy, even Easter Sunday, he's not at any church, never goes and prays anywhere, doesn't go under the roof of a place unless he's photographed properly. And who is his campaign fundraiser for the entire GOP? Paul Laxalt, who has been linked in articles. They told 60 Minutes not to do the segment on Paul Laxalt and the Mafia. Mother Jones printed it. It's been published everywhere, every major paper. They said to CBS, don't put it on until after the election. And then when the election's over, they buy CBS. I mean, they say CBS wasn't nice. Dan Rather wasn't nice to the president, and they cut all those films out. Now, how can the president of the United States have the major fundraiser be the governor of Nevada with that track record of organized crime? And that's the big party of American apple pie.